Geekscape.com.
Hello and welcome to Aryan Narrations. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, and continuing on with our series on British history, we will now begin with On the Ruin of Britain by Gildas. The island of Britain, situated on almost the utmost border of the earth, towards the south and west, and poised in the divine balance, as it is said, which supports the whole world, stretches out from the southwest towards the North Pole, and is 800 miles long and 200 broad, except where the headlands of sundry promontories stretch farther into the sea. It is surrounded by the ocean, which forms winding bays, and is strongly defended by this ample, and if I may so call it, impassable barrier, save on the south side, where the narrow sea affords a passage to Belgic Gaul. It is enriched by the mouths of two noble rivers, the Thames and the Severn, as it were two arms, by which foreign luxuries were of old imported, and by other streams of less importance. It is famous for 28 cities, and is embellished by certain castles, with walls, towers, well-barred gates, and houses, with threatening battlements built on high, and provided with all requisite instruments of defence. Its plains are spacious, its hills are pleasantly situated, adapted for superior tillage, and its mountains are admirably calculated for the alternate pasturage of cattle, where flowers of various colours, trodden by the feet of man, give it the appearance of a lovely picture. It is decked, like a man's chosen bride, with diverse jewels, with lucid fountains, and abundant brooks, wandering over the snow-white sands, with transparent rivers, flowing in gentle murmurs, and offering a sweet pledge of slumber to those who recline upon their banks, whilst it is irrigated by abundant lakes, which pour forth cool torrents of refreshing water. This island, stiff-necked and stubborn-minded, from the time of its being first inhabited, ungratefully rebels, sometimes against God, sometimes against her own citizens, and frequently also against foreign kings and their subjects. For what can there either be or be committed more disgraceful or more unrighteous in human affairs than to refuse to show fear to God or affection to one's own countrymen? And, without detriment to one's faith, to refuse due honour to those of higher dignity, to cast off all regard to reason, human and divine, and, in contempt of heaven and earth, to be guided by one's own sensual inventions. I shall, therefore, omit those ancient errors common to all the nations of the earth, in which, before Christ came in the flesh, all mankind were bound, nor shall I enumerate those diabolical idols of my country, which almost surpassed in number those of Egypt, and of which we still see some mouldering away within or without the deserted temples, with stiff and deformed features, as was customary. Nor will I call out upon the mountains, fountains, or hills, or upon the rivers, which now are subservient to the use of men, but once were an abomination and destruction to them, and to which the blind people paid divine honour. I shall also pass over the bygone times of our cruel tyrants, whose notoriety was spread over to far distant countries, so that Porphyry, that dog who in the East was always so fierce against the Church, in his mad and vain style, added this also, that Britain is a land fertile in tyrants. I will only endeavour to relate the evils which Britain suffered in the times of the Roman emperors, and also those which she caused to distant states. But so far as lies in my power, I shall not follow the writings and records of my own country, which, if there ever were any of them, have been consumed in the fires of the enemy, or have accompanied my exiled countrymen into distant lands, but be guided by the relations of foreign writers, which, being broken and interrupted, in many places are therefore by no means clear. For when the rulers of Rome had obtained the empire of the world, subdued all the neighbouring nations and islands towards the east, and strengthened their renown by the first peace which they made with the Parthians who border on India, there was a general cessation from war throughout the whole world. The fierce flame which they kindled could not be extinguished or checked by the Western Ocean, but passing beyond the sea, imposed submission upon our island without resistance, and entirely reduced to obedience its unwarlike but faithless people, not so much by fire and sword and warlike engines like other nations, but threats alone, and menaces of judgments frowning on their countenance whilst terror penetrated to their hearts. When afterwards they returned to Rome, for want of pay, as is said, and had no suspicion of an approaching rebellion, that deceitful lioness, Boadicea, put to death the rulers who had been left among them, to unfold more fully, and to confirm the enterprises of the Romans. When the report of these things reached the Senate, and they, with a speedy army, made haste to take vengeance on the crafty foxes, as they called them, there was no bold navy on the sea to fight bravely for the country. By land there was no marshalled army, no right wing of battle, nor other preparation for resistance. But their backs were their shields against their vanquishers, and they presented their necks to their swords, while chill terror ran through every limb, and they stretched out their hands to be bound, like women, so that it has become a proverb far and wide that the Britons are neither brave in war nor faithful in time of peace. The Romans, therefore, having slain many of the rebels and reserved others for slaves, that the land might not be entirely reduced to desolation, left the island, destitute as it was of wine and oil, and returned to Italy, leaving behind them taskmasters to scourge the shoulders of the natives, to reduce their necks to the yoke, and their soil to the vassalage of a Roman province, to chastise the crafty race, not with warlike weapons, but with rods, and if necessary to gird up their sides the naked sword, so that it was no longer thought to be Britain, but a Roman island, and all their money, whether of copper, gold, or silver, was stamped with Caesar's image. Meanwhile, these islands, stiff with cold and frost, and in a distant region of the world, remote from the visible sun, received the beams of light, that is, the holy precepts of Christ, the true sun, showing to the whole world his splendour, not only from the temporal firmament, but from the height of heaven, which surpasses everything temporal. At the latter part, as we know, of the reign of Tiberius Caesar, by whom his religion was propagated without impediment, and death threatened to those who interfered with its professors. These rays of light were received with lukewarm minds by the inhabitants, but they nevertheless took root among some of them, in a greater or lesser degree, until the 9 years' persecution of the tyrant Diocletian, when the churches throughout the whole world were overthrown, all the copies of the Holy Scriptures which could be found burned in the streets, and the chosen pastors of God's flock butchered, together with their innocent sheep, in order that not a vestige, if possible, might remain in some provinces of Christ's religion. What disgraceful flights then took place, what slaughter and death inflicted by way of punishment in diverse shapes, what dreadful apostasies from religion, and on the contrary, what glorious crowns of martyrdom then were won, what raving fury was displayed by the persecutors and patience on the part of the suffering saints. Ecclesiastical history informs us for the whole church were crowding in a body to leave behind them the dark things of this world, and to make the best of their way to the happy mansions of heaven as if to their proper home. God, therefore, who wishes all men to be saved, and who calls sinners no less than those who think themselves righteous, magnified his mercy towards us, and, as we know, during the above-named persecution, that Britain might not totally be enveloped in the dark shades of night, he, of his own free gift, kindled up among us bright luminaries of holy martyrs, whose places of burial and of martyrdom, had they not for our manifold crimes been interfered with and destroyed by the barbarians, would have still kindled in the minds of the beholders no small fire of divine charity. Such were St. Alban of Verulam, Aaron and Julius, citizens of Carlisle, and the rest of both sexes who in different places stood their ground in the Christian contest. The first of these martyrs, St. Alban, for charity's sake, saved another confessor, who was pursued by his persecutors and was on the point of being seized by hiding him in his house, and then by changing clothes with him, imitating in this example of Christ, who laid down his life for his sheep, and exposing himself in the other's clothes to be pursued in his stead. So pleasing to God was this conduct, that between his confession and martyrdom, he was honoured with the performance of wonderful miracles in presence of the impious blasphemers who were carrying the Roman standards and, like the Israelites of old, who trod dryfoot an unfrequented path whilst the Ark of the Covenant stood some time on the sands in the midst of Jordan, so also the martyr, with 1,000 others, opened a path across the noble River Thames, whose waters stood abrupt, like precipices, on either side. And seeing this, the first of his executors was stricken with awe, and from a wolf became a lamb, so that he thirsted for martyrdom, and boldly underwent that for which he thirsted. The other holy martyrs were tormented with diverse sufferings, and their limbs were racked in such unheard-of ways that they, without delay, erected the trophies of their glorious martyrdom, even in the gates of the city of Jerusalem. For those who survived, hid themselves in woods and deserts and secret caves, waiting until God, who is the righteous judge of all, should reward their persecutors with judgment, and themselves with protection of their lives. In less than 10 years, therefore, of the above-named persecution, and when these bloody decrees began to fail in consequence of the death of their authors, all Christ's young disciples, after so long and wintry a night, begin to behold the genial light of heaven. They rebuild the churches which had been levelled to the ground. They found, erect, and finish churches to the holy martyrs, and everywhere show their ensigns as token of their victory. Festivals are celebrated, and sacraments received with clean hearts and lips, and all the church's sons rejoice, as it were, in the fostering bosom of a mother. For this holy union remained between Christ the head and the members of his church until the Arian treason, fatal as a serpent and vomiting its poison from beyond the sea, caused deadly dissension between brothers inhabiting the same house, and thus, as if a road were made across the sea, like wild beasts of all descriptions, and darting the poison of every heresy from their jaws, they inflicted dreadful wounds upon their country, which is ever desirous to hear something new, and remains constant long to nothing. At length, also, new races of tyrants sprang up, in terrific numbers, and the island, still bearing its Roman name, but casting off her institutes and laws, sent forth among the Gauls that bitter scion of her own planting, Maximus, with a great number of followers, and the ensigns of royalty, which he bore without decency and without lawful right, but in a tyrannical manner, and amid the disturbances of the seditious soldiery. he, by cunning arts rather than by valour, attaching to his rule by perjury and falsehood all the neighbouring towns and provinces against the Roman state, extended one of his wings to Spain, the other to Italy, fixed the seat of his unholy government at Treves, and so furiously pushed his rebellion against his lawful emperors, that he drove one of them out of Rome, and caused the other to terminate his most holy life. Trusting to these successful attempts, he not long after lost his accursed head before the walls of Aquileia, whereas he had before cut off the crowned heads of almost all the world. After this, Britain is left deprived of all her soldiery and armed bands, of her cruel governors, and of the flower of her youth, who went with Maximus, but never again returned, and, utterly ignorant as she was of the art of war, groaned in amazement for many years under the cruelty of two foreign nations, the Scots from the northwest and the Picts from the north. The Britons, impatient at the assaults of the Scots and Picts, their hostilities and dreadful oppressions, sent ambassadors to Rome with letters, entreating in piteous terms the assistance of an armed band to protect them, and offering loyal and ready submission to the authority of Rome, if they only would expel their foes. A legion is immediately sent, forgetting their past rebellion, and provided sufficiently with arms. When they had crossed over the sea and landed, they came at once to close conflict with their cruel enemies, and slew great numbers of them. All of them were driven beyond the borders, and the humiliated natives rescued from the bloody slavery which awaited them. By the advice of their protectors, they now built a wall across the island from one sea to the other, which, being manned with a proper force, might be a terror to the foes whom it was intended to repel, and a protection to their friends whom it covered. But this wall, being made of turf instead of stone, was of no use to that foolish people who had no head to guide them. The Roman legion had no sooner returned home in joy and triumph than their former foes, like hungry and ravening wolves, rushing with greedy jaws upon the fold which is left without a shepherd, and, wafted both by the strength of oarsmen and the blowing wind, break through the boundaries and spread slaughter on every side, and like mowers cutting down the ripe corn, they cut up, tread underfoot, and overrun the whole country. And now again they send suppliant ambassadors, with their garments rent and their heads covered with ashes, imploring assistance from the Romans, and like timorous chickens, crowding under the protecting wings of their parents, that their wretched country might not altogether be destroyed, and that the Roman name, which now was but an empty sound to fill the ear, might not become a reproach even to distant nations. Upon this, the Romans, moved with compassion, as far as human nature can be, at the relations of such horrors, send forward, like eagles in their flight, their unexpected bands of cavalry by land and mariners by sea, and planting their terrible swords upon the shoulders of their enemies, they mow them down like leaves which fall at the destined period. And as a mounting torrent, swelled with numerous streams, and bursting its banks with roaring noise, with foaming crest and yeasty wave rising to the stars, by whose eddying currents our eyes are, as it were, dazzled, does with one of its billows overwhelm every obstacle in its way, so did our illustrious defenders vigorously drive our enemy's band beyond the sea, if any could so escape them, for it was beyond those same seas that they transported, year after year, the plunder which they had gained, no one daring to resist them. The Romans, therefore, left the country, giving notice that they could no longer be harassed by such laborious expeditions, nor suffer the Roman standards, with so large and brave an army, to be worn out by sea and land, by fighting against these unwarlike plundering vagabonds, but that the islanders, injuring themselves to warlike weapons and bravely fighting, should valiantly protect their country, their property, wives and children, and, what is dearer than these, their liberty and lives, that they should not suffer their hands to be tied behind their backs by a nation which, unless they were enervated by idleness and sloth, was not more powerful than themselves, but that they should arm those hands with buckler, sword, and spear, ready for the field of battle, and because they thought this also of advantage to the people they were about to leave, they, with the help of the miserable natives, built a wall, different from the former, by public and private contributions, and of the same structure as walls generally, extending in a straight line from sea to sea, between some cities which, from fear of their enemies, had there by chance been built. They then give energetic counsel to the timorous natives, and leave them patterns by which to manufacture arms. Moreover, on the south coast where their vessels lay, as there was some apprehension lest the barbarians might land, they erected towers at stated intervals, commanding a prospect of the sea, and then left the island never to return. No sooner were they gone than the Picts and Scots, like worms which in the heat of the midday come forth from their holes, hastily land again from their canoes, in which they had been carried beyond the Chichikan Valley, differing one from another in manners, but inspired with the same avidity for blood, and all more eager to shroud their villainous faces in bushy hair, and to cover with decent clothing those parts of their body which required it. Moreover, having heard of the departure of our friends, and their resolution never to return, they seized with greater boldness than before on all the country towards the extreme north as far as the wall. To oppose them there was placed on the heights a garrison, equally slow to fight and ill adapted to run away, a useless and panic-struck company who slumbered away days and nights on their unprofitable watch. Meanwhile, the hooked weapons of their enemies were not idle, and our wretched countrymen were dragged from the wall and dashed against the ground. Such premature death, however, painful as it was, saved them from both seeing the miserable sufferings of their brothers and children. But why should I say more? They left their cities, abandoned the protection of the wall, and dispersed themselves in flight more desperately than before. The enemy, on the other hand, pursued them with more unrelenting cruelty than before, and butchered our countrymen like sheep, so that their habitations were like those of savage beasts. For they turned their arms upon each other, and for the sake of a little sustenance, imbrued their hands in the blood of their fellow countrymen. Thus, foreign calamities were augmented by domestic feuds, so that the whole country was entirely destitute of provisions, save such as could be procured in the chase. Again, therefore, the wretched remnant, sending to Aetius, a powerful Roman citizen, addressed him as follows. To Aetius, now consul for the third time, the groans of the Britons. And again a little further thus. The barbarians drive us to the sea throws us back on the barbarians. Thus two modes of death await us. We are either slain or drowned. The Romans, however, could not assist them, and in the meantime, the discomfited people, wandering in the woods, began to feel the effects of a severe famine, which compelled many of them, without delay, to yield themselves up to their cruel persecutors to obtain subsistence. Others of them, however, lying hid in mountains, caves, and woods, continually sallied out from thence to renew the war. And then it was, for the first time, that they overthrew their enemies, who had, for so many years, been living in their country, for their trust was not in man, but in God. According to the maxim of Philo, we must have divine assistance when that of man fails. The boldness of the enemy was for a while checked, but not the wickedness of our countrymen. The enemy left our people, but the people did not leave their sins. For it has always been a custom with our nation, as it is at present, to be impotent in repelling foreign foes, but bold and invincible in raising civil war, and bearing the burdens of their offences, they are impotent. I say in following the standard of peace and truth, but bold in wickedness and falsehood. The audacious invaders therefore return to their winter quarters, determined before long again to return and plunder. And then, too, the Picts, for the first time, seated themselves at the extremity of the island, where they afterwards continued, occasionally plundering and wasting the country. During these truces, the wounds of the distressed people are healed, but another sore, still more venomous, broke out. No sooner were the ravages of the enemy checked than the island was deluged with a most extraordinary plenty of all things, greater than was before known, and with it grew up every kind of luxury and licentiousness. It grew with so firm a root that one might truly say of it, "Such fornication is heard of among you as never was known the like among the Gentiles." But besides this vice, there arose also every other to which human nature is liable, and in particular that hatred of truth, together with her supporters, which still at present destroys everything good in the island. The love of falsehood, together with its inventors, the reception of crime in the place of virtue, the respect shown to wickedness rather than goodness, the love of darkness instead of the sun, the admission of Satan as an angel of light, kings were anointed not according to God's ordinance, but such as showed themselves more cruel than the rest, and soon after they were put to death by those who had elected them, without any inquiry into their merits, but because others, still more cruel, were chosen to succeed them. If any one of these was of a milder nature than the rest, or in any way more regardful of the truth, he was looked upon as the ruiner of the country. Everybody cast a dart at him, and they valued things alike, whether pleasing or displeasing to God, unless it so happened that what displeased him was pleasing to themselves. So that the words of the prophet, addressed to the people of old, might well be applied to our own countrymen. "Children without a law, have ye left God and provoked to anger the Holy One of Israel? Why will ye still inquire, adding iniquity? Every head is languid, and every heart is sad. From the sole of the foot to the crown, there is no health in him." And thus they did all things contrary to their salvation, as if no remedy could be applied to the world by the true physician of all men. And not only the laity did so, but our Lord's own flock and its shepherds, who ought to have been an example to the people, slumbered away their time in drunkenness, as if they had been dipped in wine, whilst the swellings of pride, the jar of strife, the griping talons of envy, and the confused estimate of right and wrong got such entire possession that there seemed to be poured out, and at the same time still continueth, contempt upon princes, and to be made by their vanities to wander astray and not in the way.
RadioArian.com.